Now, I want to take a few moments to acknowledge the death of someone who's been so important to The New Yorker for so long, a master of nonfiction writing, Janet Malcolm. Janet contributed her first piece to the magazine in 1963, and she was a staff writer until her death this month. She wrote about whatever captured her interest, photography, psychoanalysis, fiction, biography, and all the complicated questions that arise from these forms. No one ever looked harder. No one ever looked with more acuity at the profession of journalism itself. Janet's book, The Journalist and the Murderer, is an essential text about the complicated, often deceptive dance that takes place between the reporter and the reported on. A decade ago, Janet spoke at the New Yorker Festival with Ian Frazier, one of her close friends and colleagues. She was 76 at the time and still writing at the very highest level, publishing astonishing personal essays, profiles, and critical pieces. And she kept doing so until very recently.
So, Janet Malcolm.
Here's Ian Frazier with Janet Malcolm in 2011.
I just spent the last months and weeks, reread everything of Janet's, and it really is fun, if you haven't had that experience, to start chronologically up until Iphigenia in Queens. And a lot of what I'm going to talk about today is, or I want to ask Janet about, is Iphigenia in Queens. The first question I want to ask you about it begins in a very dramatic way. It begins when the attorney for this woman, whose name is Marina Borukova, who was a doctor who lived in Queens and was accused of hiring a hitman to kill her husband, and she was on trial with the hitman, the accused hitman, together. And in the piece, Janet begins with the moment when the woman's lawyer puts the woman on the stand. And an entire story that preceded it somehow has to be accounted for and included in this woman's testimony. So why did you begin there?
Well, I didn't begin there when I first began trying to write the piece. I had many false starts, and none of them took me anywhere. And then this one, and I think you must find that too with your leads, as we call them in the trade, that the ones that take you somewhere become the lead. And then, or maybe you haven't had that experience. Maybe yours just comes from your head.
No, I know. You'll look and see something looks better as the lead, and it's well into the piece, maybe. But did you begin chronologically earlier than the moment?
I began with the prosecutor's narration of the story, which was, he narrated it very well himself, his version of it. But it didn't go anywhere. That's my criteria for beginnings. If they kind of peter out, then you haven't got the right one. Whereas if they keep going, you got it. And this one kept me going. And also it was a very interesting moment.
Right.
And you want to interest your reader.
I mean, she was the most interesting thing in the piece, and she was one of the most compelling characters you've ever found, I think. She was just later on in the piece, where she's kind of been humbled, and you say she looked like a captured princess in a Roman triumph parade, and suddenly you really see this woman. She wears her hair in a kind of a turban, and she's very thin, and you also compare her to a young student revolutionary in Moscow, so that when you start with her, it's really powerful, but then you do have to fill in the details of what's gone before, and what you do is it combines with the plot, in that the plot of this trial hinges on the judge, who is just a complete idiot. And it's so great to just watch an idiot. And Janet's description as she begins, the first thing she says about Judge Hanafy is his name. Hanafy is a man of 74 with a small head and a large body and the faux genial manner that American petty tyrants cultivate. just the strength of doing that, because he has to go on vacation. So he has to go on vacation, and as a result, he stops granting sidebars where the lawyers come up to talk to him because it takes too much time. And so with the sidebars, then you were able to fill in all the details. I went through, I saw each sidebar was about some other important moment. And by the sidebars that are granted and the sidebars that are denied, you manage to fill in these back.
Of course, the sidebars are the parts of the trial that the spectators don't hear, but they're transcribed. So by then getting the transcript afterwards, and this, I think, is a very crucial step for a writer covering a trial, to get that transcript in mm-hmm. order to get the sidebars.
You said that as you went along in this trial, that you understood Marina less and less. Do you feel that you understand her even less now, or how did that sort of happen?
Yeah, she was mysterious. And certainly when I interviewed the jury, it was clear that they didn't understand her at all. The jury was just completely turned off by her, that aspect of her that you were getting at with the barbarian princess image. I mean, she was just, they said she was cold and aloof and obviously not a good mom. And they all but said, that's why we convicted her, because we didn't like her. I was quite shocked that they were so frank.
You do such a great job portraying nuts. You do the best nuts of any journalist I've ever seen. And you stay with the nuts as they get nuttier and nuttier. And there's so many of these kinds of lost soul, delusional, nutty people in your pieces. Trevor Thomas, the last person to see Sylvia Plath alive, is a character in your book about Sylvia Plath and Ted Hughes. And you describe him so wonderfully. I wonder, when you see people like this, do you have literary models in your head? Are you thinking of like a character from Gogol? Are you thinking, how do you see them when you first see them?
Well, in Trevor Thomas's case, when I stepped into his house, which was a, you know, a Collier's brother's place with just this most incredible amount of stuff in a kind of almost sickening profusion.
And the dust
on, you know, there was so much dust, you felt there was kind of dust on top of dust.
Dust with its own, yeah.
Its own dust. But anyway, I immediately did think of that Borges story, The Aleph, which has something to do with some, that there's a man who kind of sees everything in the world. Is in his mind. He has that kind of a grasp, and I had that feeling of here was everything in the world, and also here was a very nice ending for my book.
Well, the description of this guy's apartment is just so great, because you've seen chaos. You see it. It's the main thing you see really in life, and yet your mind goes blank and doesn't describe it. And you said, about the chaos in his apartment, you said, "This is the way things are. This is unmediated actuality in all its multiplicity, randomness, inconsistency, redundancy, authenticity." Before the magisterial mess of Trevor Thomas's house, the orderly houses that most of us live in seem meager and lifeless. As in the same way, the narratives called biographies pale and shrink in the face of the disorderly actuality that is a life.
Yeah, I used to write well.
Thank you very much.
Janet Malcolm, who died earlier this month, was in conversation with Ian Fraser at the New Yorker Festival in 2011.